All right, we are in Job chapter 10. And you remember that in chapter 9, Job's toying with the idea of bringing his case before God at the request of his friends. And he comes to this conclusion that if God's deemed me guilty already, if God has determined I'm guilty, then there's no point, because there's no way that I'm going to change God's mind. And so you go from chapter 9 into a transition there in chapter 10. And let's read chapter 10, which says, "I loathe my own life. I will give full vent to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend with me. Is it right for you indeed to oppress, to reject the labor of your hands, and to look favorably on the schemes of the wicked? Have you eyes of flesh, or do you see as a man sees? Are your days as the days of a mortal, or your years as a man's years, that you should seek for my guilt and search after my sin? According to your knowledge, I am indeed not guilty, yet there is no deliverance from your hand. Your hands fashioned and made me altogether, and would you destroy me? Remember now that you have made me as clay, and would you turn me into dust again? Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese, clothe me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bones and sinews? You have granted me life and loving kindness, and your care has preserved my spirit. Yet these things you have concealed in your heart. I know that this is within you. If I sin, then you would not take note of me, and would not acquit me of my guilt. If I am wicked, woe to me. And if I am righteous, I dare not lift up my head. I am sated with disgrace and conscious of my misery. Should my head be lifted up, you would hunt me like a lion. And again, you would show your power against me. You renew your witness against me and increase your anger toward me. Hardship after hardship is with me. Why then have you brought me out of the womb? Would that I had died and no eye had seen me. I should have been as though I had not been, carried from womb to tomb. Would he not let my few days alone? Withdraw from me that I may have a little cheer before I go, and I shall not return to the land of darkness and deep shadow, the land of utter gloom as darkness itself, of deep shadow without order, and which shines as the darkness." Okay. You remember there at the end of chapter 9, Job makes this request for an umpire who may lay his hand on this book. Well, he doesn't so much make the request as he says, that's what I need. I need an umpire to lay his hand on both of us and come between us, between me and God, and mediate. And then he concludes, no such person is available. And in that conclusion is where he turns in chapter 10 to lament, or what you might call a protest or a complaint against God, and that God is acting in a way towards him that Job can't comprehend. You know, why is this taking place? And what Job's forced to consider now is, okay, it must be that God's angry at me. God must be mad at me. And so, in a sense, Job gets to the end of 9 there, chapter 9, and he's out of options. He doesn't know what else to do. And you can kind of just, if you can sit with Job for a moment, think about all that he's lost, all that he's enduring, and the pain and the suffering that he's going through, and he's crying out to God this whole time, and it's months and months and months later, and nothing's changed. I mean, eventually you're going to get to a point where you just think, okay, God hates me, and I don't know why. And so all I can do is complain to him, right? And so he goes in chapter 10 to that. He goes to complaint. He presents this as what he would say to God if God were there, but he's saying it to God, like it's directed at God in the second person, if that makes sense. And so you divide up the chapter, and you'll see that he really has five main points. And the first one is, there's a literary signal here that he's transitioning from the thought of litigation, which he had in chapter 9, like I'm going to bring my case before God and here's what will happen, right? That hypothetical litigation. And then he's moving into lament. That's in the first two verses. In verses 3 through 7, he asks three questions. That's the second part of the chapter. And then in verses 8 through 12, he gives this call for God to remember. And it's a really, really interesting look into Job's theology of God and man. And then fourthly, in verses 13 through 17, he's claiming that he's been unduly afflicted. He's been afflicted without cause. And then number five, he really pours out his despair. That last chapter, you know, this is his only hope left is to die and to go to the grave. So when you read this and you think about it, you have to bear in mind the whole narrative as it's taking place. If you read this as like a chapter out of the epistles, you're going to come away thinking Job's an awful guy who should never be saying anything like this. Okay? But remember, God's going to redeem Job's speech. He's going to say, yeah, this is the guy who spoke what is right about me. Everyone else spoke what is wrong. Yet when you read this, it almost seems irreverent. Okay? Remember what Job's going through in his life, and remember now he feels as though God is against him, and all the evidence in the world in his life would say, yes, God is against you. And so he's trying to wrestle with this. So notice this transition in the first two verses. I loathe my own life. I will give full vent to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend with me. You notice this in verse 35. Then I would speak and not fear him, but I am not like that in myself. Okay, so to get what's happening, he expresses that desire for the umpire, the mediator. He reasons that if I had a mediator, I would be able to express my case and it would be a fair court, right? One who would say, okay, everybody stop afflicting Job, let him make his case, let it be heard, and then we'll try to figure this out. But there's no one to do that, right? So he ends the verse saying, I can't pull this off. I am not like this in myself. So what he's doing is ending the idea of, we're just going to call it litigation. And he's moving into lament now. So having explained this idea of bringing this case before God and determining it is not going to do any good if God's already made up his mind, Job's just going to complain. Now, there's a difference between what we're going to call lament, which is protest prayer, and murmuring, right? Murmuring is when you don't get your coffee right at the Starbucks. You know, they mess up the order or something. And you go about your day upset, and it ruins your whole day. That's murmuring. Job, if anybody has cause to complain, it's Job, right? Legitimate cause to complain. No one is suffering like him. And the terrible agony that he is facing is what gives full vent to his complaint. I loathe my own life. Right, this is the place he's at. I hate my life. I loathe it. I despise it completely. And so I'm just going to complain about it because inwardly this is how I feel. And I think there's a sense in which Job recognized God already knows what he's thinking. And so he needs to voice these things in front of everybody. Job's not a hypocrite, if anything, right? He's not putting on the smiley face in the midst of his problems and pretending that everything's okay when it isn't. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul, he says. And that last bit of bringing a case before God comes out in verse 2. I will say to God, do not condemn me. let me know why you contend with me. That's the last thing he's got, right? Okay, please God, stop doing this to me and tell me what this is all about. Like, explain to me what's happening. So what he's going to do here, from Job's perspective, he's going to give an emotional outburst before God in an attempt to get God to come and talk with him and tell him what's going on. And it's not manipulative in any sense, but it's his last resort. This is the last thing he can do, is just pour out his complaints of his heart before God and hope that God will answer him. The great thing is, we know what happens. God comes and answers him. God comes and speaks to Job about this. And so from here on, Job is lamenting what he perceives to be unjust treatment from God to him. Now, again, we know what's going on, okay? As you move into this lament, you have to consider that situation and the limitation of Job's knowledge. Okay, it's kind of hard for us to say, to give any advice to Job, because we know what's going on, right? In our minds, we're like, Job, there's a big test going on between God and Satan. You need to just ease it up, brother, and kind of take it on the chin. Job doesn't know this is happening. From all sense perception that he can muster, and remember, he doesn't have the scriptures that tell him that God loves him in Christ and that he's forgiven and that all things work together for good. All Job knows is the natural theology of retribution. And so he's convinced God must be against me. And so then he moves on here. He begins to ask these questions, and there's three of them. And these really start the lament. So verse 3, is it right for you indeed to oppress, to reject the labor of your hands, and to look favorably on the schemes of the wicked? Now, another way you could translate that is, does it please you to oppress me? Which I think is actually a better translation. I think maybe the ESV has it that way. Is that how it has it? Yeah. Does it please you to oppress me? So what Job's wondering now, okay, is God made happy in afflicting me? Is this something that makes God happy? And we don't really get a resolution to why God, or why Job is asking this about God. Does it please God to destroy Job? And Job's wondering this, I think, maybe for a couple reasons. He's beginning to question what he knows about God. Does it please God to oppress the innocent? And then secondly, I wonder if he's also thinking, well, if this pleases God, then just let me know that this pleases you and I'll submit to it. You know, he's such a man of faith. I wonder if that's also going through his mind. To reject the labor of your hands is something he's going to go into more detail about in verses 8 through 12. So he's just kind of bringing that idea up. Job is the product of God's labor. And now he's saying, why are you rejecting me? Why are you throwing me off? But the contrast is really in the last line there. And to look favorably on the schemes of the wicked. So there's two things he's contrasting here. Is it right? Does it please you to oppress me? In contrast to looking favorably on the schemes of the wicked. Now, this is actually an age-old question. The psalmists do a lot of asking about this. Why do the righteous suffer, and it appears as though the evil are prospering? I ask this question. I ask the question, why does a guy like Joel Osteen have a, you know, I don't know how many thousands of people in his church on Sunday, and I don't? Why do the wicked prosper? You know, maybe it's your work. You know people who are unbelievers and vile and terrible, and they're moving to the top of the ladder. And maybe you're still down here somewhere, and you ask the question, why are the wicked prospering? And so this is what Job's asking. Why am I, a righteous man, being punished, and it seems as though you're taking pleasure in the schemes of the wicked? And the point for Job is this. If indeed God has marked Job as wicked, and he delights more in afflicting Job than in punishing the unrighteous, then Job's determination is, I'd rather be dead if this is the way that God works. Now, I think we'd all agree. Like, if the way that God works is that He takes pleasure in afflicting the innocent while looking favorably on the schemes of the wicked, man, there's just not much hope in this life. There's not much hope in a future either. And yet we also have a very important theme that comes out here. What do we do when God says in Isaiah, it pleased the Lord to crush him? You know, it pleased God to crush the Son. In the sense what Job's asking here, does it make you happy to afflict me? When it comes to Jesus, in a sense, God was pleased to crush his only Son. And so Job doesn't have the full picture because Job doesn't have the category of redemptive suffering. Redemptive suffering is the category Job needs. And if you have that category, then you can know that God, in allowing affliction in the lives of his people, is pleased by it because of the greater good that it brings about. But Job doesn't have that. Right? The book of Job is, here's your introduction to redemptive suffering. Whole world, here's how God deals with people. And so, so death to Job is preferable to this contrast that he's made. You're either oppressing the righteous and taking pleasure in the wicked, and that's it, and if that's it, I want to die. But he doesn't have the other category of redemptive suffering. And so that contrast is key. That's really what his lament is built on. The next two questions, one writer called them absurd questions in the style of disputation. Okay, verses 4 and 5 say, have you eyes of flesh, or do you see as a man sees? Are your days as the days of a mortal, or your years as a man's years? All right, so he moves from that. And I think the first question is, I think these are rhetorical, right? No, I don't think Job is really thinking that, but that's what he's perceiving, and he wants God to bring resolution. Because these are really rhetorical. What he's saying here is, God, you actually can't know and understand what it's like to be human. You don't know what it's like to be me. Now, I think this is interesting because this is really good theology. So good that most Christians don't have this because it's uncomfortable to think in this way. God does not know suffering. God does not experience suffering. God has never had a bad day. And so, in Job's case, what he knows about the impassible God, which is the doctrine that he's building this whole argument on, is that God can't know how terrible Job's suffering actually is. And the struggle goes the other way as well. It's very hard to be a human experiencing suffering while not understanding God's motives and goals. Right? We don't get what's going on. And so he's saying, how can you, the unchangeable, impassible, eternal God, all three of those things are going to be brought up here. God doesn't change. He doesn't have moments like we experience moments. He's eternal. He's impassible. He suffers nothing. God in all of those attributes means that God can't, in his divine nature, truly identify with people. I had talked about when I preached on impassibility. We can't expect God to say, yeah, I know what it's like to suffer grief, because God doesn't suffer grief. Now, you understand, this is why the incarnation is so wonderful. Because Jesus, as he comes as fully man, endures all of these things as truly man and truly God. This is the umpire we need to bring us both together, to lay hands on both of us. Because God can't experience those things as the perfect being. And so, remember though, Job has no concept of incarnation yet. I mean, I think he may have a little bit. The seed of the woman promise was his gospel. But he doesn't have it. He doesn't have it to the degree we have it. So what he raises is a really good point. You can't suffer God. So what I'm going to do is appeal to this as a way of complaint. It's sort of like what we might say to someone who's never experienced suffering like we've experienced. We would say, you actually don't know what I'm going through. Right? Except this is to a greater degree. Like God has never even been a little bit sad in his existence. Never had even a little bit of a bad day. So he says, you don't have eyes of flesh. You don't see as a man sees, which is the limitations, right? God, you're seeing everything, the whole picture. I'm seeing this limited picture, and you're forgetting that that's all I can see. You don't know what it's like to only have a limited amount of time in life and a limited perception of what's going on around you. You don't have years like a mortal, he says. All right. So Job is watching his whole life just slip away. Right. Remember, he talked about that in chapter 9. It's just going by him quickly. Our lives go quick. And Job's saying to God, you don't know what this is like. You've never experienced this. And again, you can really see why the incarnation is just so vital to fill out this picture. You know, because Jesus lives a pretty short life. And he dies a quick death. And things go by quickly for him. So he can understand us in that sense. So he picks up on that in verses 6 through 7 here. He says, that you should seek for my guilt and search after my sin. According to your knowledge, I am indeed not guilty, yet there is no deliverance from your hand. So this is kind of tough here. It translates really, really poorly into the English. I don't even know how you'd make it better. What he's saying is, you don't have years like a man, and you don't get what it's like to be mortal and watch your life waste away. And my point is this. Why are you wasting my life away on seeking out my guilt and seeking after my sins? You know, why are you pursuing me like this when I have such a limited time in life? So in Job's mind, what we're seeing here now is just a glimpse into what he thinks God's doing. He thinks God is finding every little wrong and fault and sin, anything that Job could possibly do that's wrong, and he's using it against Job as a reason to destroy him. This is the place Job has arrived at. So any infraction in his heart or mind, he thinks God's just using that to come against him in wrath. It's an amazing book because we know what's going on. And then we see what's going on in Job's mind, and we can go, you know, with complete confidence. You know, it's like you're screaming at Job. That's not what's happening, Job. That's not at all what's going on. And I think it's important because although we don't experience what Job experiences, you'll never get there, right? Remember, you've never been as high as Job. You'll never be as low as Job. But the extremes are there to teach us that when we get to this place, God must hate me. God must be mad at me. We can yell at ourselves, no, there is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. God's not mad at me. God's not angry at me. This is just redemptive suffering. I'm going through redemptive suffering for whatever purpose God has. And it gives us that category to say, I don't know what God's going on, but if I look back at Job, it's got to be something important. It's got to be something good. So in verse 7, you see his clear defense of his innocence. According to your knowledge, God's knowledge, I am indeed not guilty. So he's saying to God, you must be finding sins that I can't even figure out. You're seeking out my guilt. You're searching after every sin. But you know I am indeed not guilty. Yet there is no deliverance from your hand. And he's really confident in his innocence. And he's saying, I'm not doing anything to deserve this. And you know it, God. You know I don't deserve this. And you imagine, I try to, maybe my imagination goes too far. I imagine God going, yeah, I know, Job. Like, I'm not coming after you for that reason. That's a whole different reason. If God was a man, he would be very frustrated at Job at this point, I'm sure, but he's not. So Job is not seeking an umpire anymore. You notice the word there in verse 7. He's looking now for deliverance. He wants to be delivered. He wants to be delivered from what he perceives to be God's wrath. Someone to rescue him from God's hand. Now, again, these are bold statements from Job. He's saying things that I think we as evangelical Christians would tend to rebuke people for saying. Because we like the cloak of piety. We like to pretend that everything is always okay, and that no matter what, we should never give voice to our complaints, because that would be to expose a lack of faith. Job doesn't have a lack of faith. This is actually the opposite. This is an expression of strong faith. He is so comfortable with who he knows God is that he will give full vent to his complaint to God. He's just like, I'm gonna let it all hang out. I'm not going to hide anything. I'm going to tell God exactly what I think is going on. And he's not sinning against the Lord. He's just saying, I don't get this. I don't get what's taking place, and I want to know what's going on. Think about this. Who would ever guess in this situation? This must be God and Satan putting together a test, because I'm the most righteous man in the world. And Satan said that the only reason I'm righteous is because God gives me gifts. And God said, no, he has real faith. That must be what's going on. There's no way to ever conclude this. And again, it just helps us in our trials to go, we have no idea what's going on. And we just have to live on the truths that God has given to us and kind of make them the mantra of our life. So again, as bold as the words are, don't think they're sinful. They're not sinful. He is an innocent man. He is indeed suffering as a result of God's actions. Remember, God's the one who puts Job up on the chopping block. His words are deeply rooted in a faith that expresses his desire to be right with God. I hope you're hearing that through Job's voice. He thinks there's a problem between him and God, and his only concern is, I want this problem resolved. I want my relationship with God to be right. I want it to be good again. And what he doesn't know is that he is right with God. This Sunday I'll be preaching on the confession of sin and assurance of pardon. This is how vital that assurance of pardon is for your Christian life. To know every week and be reminded every week, you are right with God through Jesus Christ. By faith alone, apart from any works of the law, no matter how rotten you have been this week, by faith alone, you are right with God in Jesus Christ. And Job doesn't have that, right? He doesn't have that assurance of pardon going on right now. So he moves now to plead. He's going to plead with God to remember things. So you don't know what it's like to be human. So please remember that I am your creation. You made me. Psalm 103:14 says, "For he himself knows our frame. He is mindful that we are but dust." God knows, but Job thinks, man, God must have forgot who I am and what I am. Okay, verses 8 and 9. "Your hands fashioned and made me altogether, and would you destroy me? Remember now that you have made me as clay, and would you turn me into dust again?" Now, you see the creation narrative stuff going on there, right? He's playing on that idea. His appeal is that in the act of creating him, God has in some way committed himself to care for his creation. So remember, we're seeing this in Genesis 2. God creates the man, and then he provides for the man. He gives him all the things he needs. And Job's saying, based on God's previous work in creation, God's previous work in creating me and bringing me forth from the womb, it doesn't make sense, God, for you to now destroy me. This doesn't make sense at all. In Job's mind, this is a violation of God's promise to provide for his creation. So, how does Job resolve this idea that the same hands that were so full of mercy and compassion and tender care in forming him are now the hands that are crushing him? So look at verse 10. Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese? Now, when I first read that, I think that's a bad thing, right? You read it as a bad thing. But that's actually a good thing. Okay, so, and we're removed from this because we don't pour out milk and curdle it like cheese very often. I'm waiting for my goats to give me more milk so I can do this. Like, really anxious to try this, but to make cheese, that is. And the idea here is, he's saying, you didn't take these raw materials and turn them into something very special, right? Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese? That's a positive thing. 11 and 12 go on. Clothe me with skin and flesh. Knit me together with bones and sinews. You have granted me life and loving kindness, and your care has preserved my spirit. Okay, all of these are just metaphors for the, I guess you could say, the birthing conception process. Like milk made into cheese. Job was clothed with skin and flesh. He was knit together with sinews and bones. And the point is that God oversees and orders the whole process of his development in the womb and his being brought forth from the womb and him growing into a man. And in verse 12, it's clear. You have granted me life and loving kindness, and your care has preserved my spirit. God, you gave me life. You preserved my life. And this signifies a covenant relationship that God creates, and then he also sustains his creation. And Job's saying to God, I want you to remember this. In the midst of my affliction, when it seems as though your hands are crushing me, remember, you're the one who made me. And he wants God to now turn from this crushing action back to a way that sustains and helps him. But in verse 13 through 17, he kind of returns to the complaint. Yet, these things you have concealed in your heart. I know that this is within you. If I sin, then you would take note of me and would not acquit me of my guilt. If I am wicked, woe to me. And if I am righteous, I dare not lift up my head. I am sated with disgrace and conscious of my misery. Should my head be lifted up, you would hunt me like a lion. And again, you would show your power against me. You renew your witness against me and increase your anger toward me. Hardship after hardship is with me. Okay, Job's going to say things like this throughout the rest of the book. When you get to the end of the book, remember we have this part about Job repenting. Okay, this is what Job is repenting of. He is assigning false motives to God. You know, God does not hold this against him because Job's perception is this is what's happening. And so understanding this, I think, is important. So he goes from remember to an accusation. Okay, it seems that God's care and concern for him was just concealing a desire to scrutinize Job's behavior and bring hard punishments on Job for any infraction. That's what verses 13 and 17 are saying. Yet these things you have concealed in your heart, I know that this is within you. This is now he's accusing God. Okay, and again, this doesn't. It doesn't fall into a category of sin, because what he's doing is expressing his perception of God. He's not saying, God, you're tricky and you're a liar. He's saying, this is what it seems like to me, God. Now, I don't know about you, I've prayed prayers like this. You know, God, it really seems like you're not on my side anymore. Right? As I look at the situation, I feel like you're pretty mad at me right now, and I can't see any good coming out of what's going to happen here. That's the idea that Job has. You note verse 14, if I sin, then you would take note of me and would not acquit me of my guilt. So, to Job, God is there eagerly anticipating any chance he might get to punish Job for the slightest infraction, the smallest thing. And it seems to Job that God is unwilling to forgive him at all. Like, I'm asking for forgiveness. I'm searching my heart. I can't find sin. You would not acquit me of guilt. You just keep punishing me for infractions that I don't even know I'm doing. And then in verse 15, if I am wicked, woe to me. And if I am righteous, I dare not lift up my head. Now notice this, what he's saying, the contrast. If I am wicked, woe to me. In other words, if I'm wicked, I get punished. If I'm a sinner, I'm getting wrath from you. But also, if I'm righteous, I dare not lift up my head. You know what he's saying, right? I'm damned if I do, and I'm damned if I don't. If I sin, you come after me. If I don't sin, you come after me. And no matter what I do in between, you're still punishing me. And so this is the context of 16 and 17. Should my head be lifted up? Should I say I'm righteous and proclaim my righteousness? Here's what you would do. You would hunt me like a lion. And again, you would show your power against me and renew your witness against me and increase your anger toward me. Hardship after hardship is with me. So here's Job's position in life. To lift up your head is to defend your righteousness, or to stand and say, I'm righteous. And he's saying, as I do that, I'm just met by an increase in suffering. It just get it worse. So no matter what I do, God, if I do what's right, you hunt me down like a lion. And then you show your power against me. No matter what I do, God, you renew your witness against me. No matter what I do, your anger towards me increases. No matter what I do, hardship after hardship is my lot in this life. I can't win. I can't win, and I'm frustrated, and I've come to the end of my rope. I don't know what else to do other than just cry out in complaint to you. And so when you get to this point, you're convinced that there's nothing you can do to get God on your side, or be on God's side, I guess you could put it that way. The only thing you have left is despair. Okay? I think one of the deepest passages in Scripture is when Judas goes and throws the silver into the temple. And he says, I've betrayed innocent blood. And the Pharisees respond to him and say, what is that to us? See to it yourself. And Judas is left. Now, Judas is a traitor, and he deserved to die and get punishment. I get all that. But what Judas was left with at that point from those religious leaders was, fix this yourself. And Judas knows, there's no way I can fix this. And what does the next verse say? Judas goes out and hangs himself. Right? This is what despair, when we get to a place where we're convinced that God is against us, your only move is despair. There's nowhere else to go. And this is the context of verse 18. Why then have you brought me out of the womb? Would that I had died, and no eye had seen me. I should have been as though I had not been, carried from womb to tomb. The poetry even comes out in the English there. It's like the best part where it actually comes out in the English. So his consideration of God's intricate care in shaping him, in forming him, in sustaining him. And now he just can't conceive of why God would subject him to such horrible pain and agony. And the worst part about it is he's now convinced this is because God is against him. And because God is against him, he's saying, it would have been better had I just died at birth. Right, we're going all the way back to chapter 3. I should have just died at birth, gone straight from the womb into the tomb, and all I'm looking forward to now is death. I just want to die. That's the only hope he's got left is the grave. Verse 20 says, would he not let my few days alone? So now we don't really know who he's talking to, right? Withdraw from me that I may have a little cheer before I go, and I shall not return to the land of darkness and deep shadow, the land of utter gloom as darkness itself, of deep shadow without order, and which shines as the darkness. And as you read that lament, if you read it in the right context, I think it just makes sense. That's where you would go, and that's what we would all say. There is a sense, I think, as we read that, we're tempted, at least I know I am, it's like, man, I could just give Job the answers. Just tell him what's going on. And I think that's a temptation we have to resist in our reading, but also as this plays out in practical life. Because I think, really and truly, this is all of us at some point in our lives. We all get this low at some point where we see life is so futile and we don't feel God's presence with us. We don't think He's for us and we abandon hope and just want to die. I think that we're fooling ourselves if we say that's never happened. And maybe if it hasn't happened yet, trust me, it'll happen. You get to this point. All of us will wonder, why is life so hard? I mean, if you don't wonder that, I guess I envy you. You look at everything that's going on and you go, why does it have to be like this? Why does it have to be difficult, God? Why does everything have to be so weak? Why does it have to be so hard? Why does it have to be so miserable? Why, God, do you do the things that you do? You know? I think about my friends who just lost their baby not too long ago. And in my perception, I look at that and I go, why? What was the point in that? I can't see anything redemptive in that. And I ask the question, why do you do the things you do, God? Not because I'm like trying to think that I know better than God, but like Job, I genuinely want to know, why was that better? I remember one of my seminary professors said this once in a lecture on pastoral theology where he said, he mentioned a scenario that had happened and he says, I still am not comfortable with that and I still ask God every day, I think you messed up on that one. You're going to have to explain that to me. And I used to think, man, what an arrogant, pompous jerk. But all he was doing was giving vent to what's actually in his heart, which is an act of faith, to know that God can actually handle that and go, yeah, I know, you're but dust. You don't know what goes on. And this should be a bit confusing to you because I haven't asked you to live by sight. I've actually asked you all to live by faith. And faith can be hard, right? It can be hard to just believe God works all things together for good. We can make that so trite in our lives. Why does it sometimes feel like God's angry with me? You know, that song we were practicing earlier, I asked the Lord that I might grow. Right? When we sing that on Sunday, think about Job. Why does it feel like God's mad at me? Will thou pursue thy worm to death? You know, that's what he's saying in the song. Why did God create us? Why does God sustain us and then allow us to suffer? You know, what's the point of all of that? Why in the midst of suffering does it feel like no matter what we do, it only gets worse? You ever notice that in the midst of, like, here's the moment I really need God's presence to be felt. I need comfort. Those are the moments God doesn't comfort you. I mean, it's so frustrating. And then when I don't need God's comfort, God's there. You know, I have this felt presence there. He's comforting me and things are well. But when I'm in the dumps and things are bad, I don't remember a time feeling God's presence come and comfort me. And that's because we're walking by faith. We can say of life, hardship after hardship is with me. Because that's what it is, to bear a cross and follow Christ. It is hardship after hardship. But when we get to the point of despair is when we ask the question, why was I ever born? Okay? And the point of despair, we ask this question because we're frail and our faith is weak and it falters at times. But it's a question that I don't think we have the total right to ask, because God's given us the answers, right? He's told us. Yep, there is redemptive suffering. There is suffering that is for the glory of my name and nothing else. But these are all real questions that we can ask. We can ask. We can ask, why have you brought me forth out of the womb? We can ask, God, from my perception, it seems like it had been better if I'd have just died. Why do you have me going through this? That's just part of being human. And here's what's interesting. Faith is to know God's word and believe it, right? To know what God says and to believe what God says. It's knowledge, it's assent to that knowledge, and it's trust. You know, those are the three things that make up faith. And we can wonder at times why we don't see the end. And yet, instead of falling into unbelief, we can just go to God and ask Him to reconcile things in our hearts. Right? I think we're terrified to do that. To go to God and just say, I don't see the point in this anymore, and you're going to have to show me what's going on, or you're going to have to give me, you know, an increase in faith so that I can get through this. And here's the thing. Sometimes God reconciles it and shows you, and most of the time He doesn't. Right? And He just gives you the strength to keep living by faith. But we still have to ask, because we still have to go through this, because it's part of our journey. Right? It's part of our sanctification to be stretched beyond what we know and are sure of, so that our faith will actually grow. It's part of our dealing with life, dealing with God, and maintaining our hope, is that we get to places like Job, and instead of running away from God, we run to God with the questions. And we just wait. You know, God sometimes tells us what's going on, sometimes He doesn't. In fact, in the book of James, chapter 5, James plays on this idea. Chapter 5, verse 10, he says, "As an example, brethren, of suffering and patience, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord." Just pause there. Have you ever thought about, like, if you lived in the Old Testament period, the last thing in the world you want to get called to is a prophet, right? Life doesn't end well for the prophets. You think about in the New Testament, the apostles, man, they all had terrible persecution and died at the hands of the Romans, with the exception of John. The last thing you want to do is be a prophet or an apostle, because that means you've got a really hard road to bear. And so James says, as an example of suffering and patience, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. We count those blessed who endured. He says, "You have heard of the endurance of Job and seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings, that the Lord is full of compassion and is merciful." And so when we get to these places, we have these guys that we can look back at and say, here's what happened to them. Here's how God dealt with them. Here's the outcome of God dealing with them. God really is full of compassion. God really is merciful. And God's going to show me something great through all of this. And I think that's helpful for us. So Job's perception may be wrong, but his desire, his deepest desire here, is that he wants God's word on the matter. Job wants God to figure out and tell him what's going on and explain it to him. And it's so great. I know I'm jumping ahead. It's so great. God comes and does not tell Job what's going on. And Job's okay with it. Job gets his answer in full when God comes and reveals himself to Job. So, okay, that's Job chapter 10.